Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 88, Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether it is, well, required reading. As always, I'm your host, Tom Panarese, and along for the ride with me is my fellow time traveler. Neither of us is somebody in this book, because if we were going to be time travelers, we would need a pig to go with us. So it's a whole different show, and I wouldn't want to leave Waddles behind. It's Stella.
Thank you. Yes. And I think that I would probably be either framed for a crime or left in the past, because my empathy would definitely get me into trouble.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I think me too. So how are you?
I don't know, you know, it's just stress. It's do we ever have a good time of things? I'm doing okay. It's just the kind of the future, I guess, as everyone says, but just this the job, looking for the jobs, trying to be a Latin teacher seems to be hard. And you had said before the call, and even other people were saying this, my family was saying this, like, I thought we were in a teacher shortage. And I'm like, listen, we might be, but apparently not for Latin. Yeah. But yeah, just kind of pushing on. And, you know, last episode, I said that I was in this deep, dark hole of smut reading. And boy, I'm sure. So maybe one day I'll get out of it. But that kind of brings me, honestly, it's like a find your joy thing, because amidst the stressors of the day, I can pick up a hockey smut and enjoy myself. So good and bad, riding the waves of life, as I like to say.
That's probably how this is the discussion for another day, but it'd be interesting to see between you and me what we define as smut.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting to see what maybe a sort of a male / female dichotomy view of, like, juxtaposition of it, because their division, the descriptions, oh my God, can I speak tonight? Our ideas of it might be different.
Yes. I think, yeah, that would be, what would that be? Would that be enough for a special? We'd have to read smut and then discuss it.
I'm sure we could find some.
Of course. I've got tons of recommendations that I could make.
Yeah. But no Colleen Hoover, please.
No, I do actually have a legitimate problem with that particular author. But yeah,
I've heard a number of complaints about her, and I'm like, I don't think I would want to read any of her stuff.
Yeah.
So. All right. Cool.
But here we are to talk about. Yeah. A good book, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I've been looking forward to this one for a little while too, because I have, this is one of those I bought and put on my shelf, and I'm like, oh yeah, I could read this now. So, so the book is Sea of Tranquility. It is by Emily St. John Mandel. This is her, this is not her third novel, but, like, we did Station 11, and then there was a novel called The Glass Hotel, which was published in 2020. And this was published just a couple of years ago. So this is her most recent book. So I don't think that either of us will have much of a history with it, considering it's so recent. So, I mean, I assume yours would be pretty close to mine. What is it?
Yeah, so mine, I think I was aware of this and probably pretty quickly read it. So this is my second read through, which embarrassingly, like as I was editing The Price of Salt and we had that whole discussion because you were like talking about this book and I was like, oh, is it the one with like the thing in the forest? And you're like, I don't know, I've never read it. And I thought, oh, I thought you had. So I have read it before. I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads the first time. I think maybe my rating would not change. And so this is my second one. So I feel like I probably read it pretty quickly after it dropped.
Yeah, this is my history with it too. So we had read, I had read Station 11 for the first time when you had us on to do it. And I was in a bookstore downtown doing, I think it was buying Christmas gifts or something, and saw it on display. And I was like, oh, wow. So I grabbed it. And then funny enough, owned this before I owned the Glass Hotel. Is that, that was the second one, right? And then I was in 2020, in a couple of years ago, was in the Outer Banks and saw that book at a bookstore there and bought it and read it at the beach, and then decided that I was going to take this one off the shelf for the show and read it for the first time. So yeah, so it's just it's pretty much a contemporary work, which I believe is, well, I did on purpose too, because I had picked two really old works of literature for my last two episodes, so I wanted to switch it around and be a little bit more contemporary. So if you go back to our episode about Station 11, you will get a bio of the author that Stella gave us. So what I'm going to do is give us just the history of the book itself, comments made like in an interview with Mandel talking about her inspiration behind the book and you know, how she wrote it, et cetera, et cetera. So Sea of Tranquility, like I said, was published in 2022. It is a time travel science fiction novel that starts in 1912 and fast forwards all the way to 2401. The inspiration, according to an interview that Mandel did with Wisconsin Public Radio, came from a time travel stories being some of her favorite. I've always enjoyed time travel, she said. I love it. I love time travel film. And one of her very favorite movies is Rian Johnson's film Looper. I have not seen that. There's a lot of movies I haven't seen. So most of what's coming after is actually more or less verbatim, directly from that Wisconsin Public Radio interview. So their words, not mine. Mandel said she probably wouldn't have written Sea of Tranquility if it were not for the coronavirus pandemic. She started the writing process in the spring of 2020, which she said in New York City was as horrifying as you might have gleaned from the New York Times reports. And there was something about the awfulness of that historical moment that made me feel like I'm just going to go for it. She said, I'm going to write whatever I want because the world is terrible. So that was the starting point for Sea of Tranquility. And once I realized that it was going to be a time travel novel, I feel like that's only fun. Or if it was only fun for me, if I got to traverse an enormous amount of time. So it's one that she's said is actually it's fascinating for most people. And she says, you know, how do you explain the popularity of sites like Ancestry.com or 23andMe, if not some kind of desire to meet our ancestors? She said, figuring out how a story starts and ends is the draw. When I read about different points in time, it's hard not to try to imagine what life would have been like in those moments. So the character of Edwin St. John St. Andrew is actually loosely based on one of Mandel's great-grandfathers who she's always been fascinated by. He left London around 1908 or so, 18 years old, under the cloud of some unspecified scandal. And then he had a really strange, rocky life in Canada and the United States because he just had no skills that would translate to the real world. He was the recipient of this beautiful classic education, went to very exclusive schools, probably spoke Latin and Greek, but just had no idea how to make it in the world. And there was something always kind of interesting and poignant about that to me. She continued, she said, I knew I wanted to revisit that time period, and then I knew I wanted to go really far into the future as well. So Edwin is one of the three protagonists of the book. Another is a writer named Olive Llewellyn, who has a best-selling novel about a pandemic that's being turned into a movie. The storyline mirrors Mandel's real-life experience with Station 11, although she's not ever and right now is not living on the moon. Mandel wanted to show the reader how strange a book tour can be through Olive's experience based on her own tours. Every interaction that Olive has in this section is completely autobiographical, she said. Those are things that people actually said to me on the road. Most interactions with readers are wonderful. It's one of the great pleasures of going out on the road, she added. But man, that 1% is really something else.
So that means that there is someone writing a book about the rats?
Possibly. Characters from the Glass Hotel appear in Sea of Tranquility, and she explains that by saying, sometimes I just become attached to particular characters, and that's why Miranda and Leon from Station 11 are in the Glass Hotel. She said, sometimes I'll be writing a book, and I'll realize that for the point in time and the place I'm writing about, the characters I can pull in from another book. And that's why there are three characters from the Glass Hotel in Sea of Tranquility. So reviews. A number of positive reviews and praise. Yvonne C. Garrett has called it Sea of Tranquility in the Brooklyn Rail, beautifully written, being an equal part vast and intimate, quiet and thrilling contemplation on humanity, physics, time, and what it means to be alive. In the Washington Post, Ron Charles says it's a science fiction that keeps its science largely in abeyance as dark matter for a story about loneliness, grief, and finding purpose. Laird Hunt argued in the New York Times that it's one of Mandel's finest novels, one of her most satisfying forays into the area of speculative fiction. And Beth Ann Patrick saw a novel that is pure pleasure to read in the Los Angeles Times. She says, you see the strands and later the beautiful results, but your eyes simply cannot follow what comes in between. There were a few negative reviews. Constant Grady, writing for Vox, argued that the loveliness of Mandel's sentences stands in jarring contrast to the clumsiness of her plotting. In her mind, the different sections of this novel are linked by a time travel mystery, and the Mysteries of Revolution is so patent cliched that if she were to describe the setup, one would know immediately how it all worked out. But it did win awards. It was listed on Barack Obama's 2022 annual summer reading list. It was named as one of his favorite books of the year. The novel was long listed for the 2023 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. It was picked by Stephen Bush as one of the Financial Times critics' best picks for best books of 2022. Furthermore, it was one of Amazon's 20 best books for the year of 2022. The novel won the Goodreads Choice Award for Best Science Fiction in 2022. And in April of that year, it was announced that HBO Max will adapt the novel and The Glass Hotel into television series, each produced by Paramount Television Studios, with Mandel and Patrick Somerville co-writing. No word on what the status of that is, considering the disaster that has been the Warner Brothers Discovery merger, which changed HBO Max into Max, and the fact that there was a prolonged writer's strike over the last year or so. So we'll have to see if they come out. Anything before I go into the plot synopsis?
No.
So I grabbed the plot synopsis from Wikipedia. Just completely, I'm like, do I really want to go back and rewrite this? The way they outline the plot synopsis in Wikipedia, it is sort of in line with what's in the novel, but they break it down by character. All right. So we're going a little bit linearly through the plot, but I think there's a little bit jumping back and forth here and there over the course of the book. Anyway, and there are things that are left out of this plot synopsis, a couple of characters that are left out of this plot synopsis, but I do have questions about them in the questions. So you'll learn a little bit about people like Talia, for instance, who is one of the characters in the book.
That was left out of the plot synopsis?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. All right. Yeah, because it's one of my favorite things. Anyway, so in 1912, we had Edwin St. John St. Andrew, who's the youngest grandson of an English earl. He scandalizes his father at a dinner party by criticizing the British Raj and is exiled to Canada as a remittance man. Passive in nature, he drifts from Halifax West to Victoria, British Columbia. Beset by ennui toward Victoria's similarity to English high society, he travels to Cayette, a fictional settlement. And this is actually where the hotel was in the Glass Hotel, because it's on Vancouver Island. Venturing into a forest, Edwin is overwhelmed by momentarily experiencing being within a vast, dark space, hearing a violin and other sounds he cannot recognize. A stranger named Roberts, claiming to be a priest, questions him about this experience, but flees when Edwin becomes suspicious. In 2020, there's Morella. Years after Vincent Alakaitis' disappearance during the events of the Glass Hotel, her friend, Morella Kessler, seeking her whereabouts, attends an audiovisual art performance by Vincent's brother, Paul Smith. Paul plays a childhood video filmed by Vincent in which, like Edwin, she is momentarily transported from a forest to a dark train station-like space where a violin is heard. Morella is devastated upon learning of Vincent's disappearance at sea. Then, as a man named Gaspard Jacques Robert, that's how I'm going to say it, or Roberts, who accidentally betrays foreknowledge of the COVID-19 pandemic to them, questions her about the video, Morella is disturbed to recognize him, seemingly not having aged from a traumatic murder scene which she witnessed as a child in Ohio. Let's jump to 2203. And Olive Llewellyn, a native of the Moon Colony and a novelist, she's away from her husband and daughter on a weeks-long Earthbound international book tour. She headlines numerous media events and lectures promoting her breakthrough novel, Marienbad, about an imaginary influenza pandemic. All the while, reports of a string of real-world viral outbreaks escape her attention. Gaspare, I'm just going to use his first name, non-hyphenated, for brevity's sake. Gaspare, who shares the first name of a character in Marienbad, interviews Olive as a journalist and questions her about a passage in Marienbad describing a character in a spaceport hearing a violin and being transported. And finally, we have who is our protagonist, our main protagonist, Gaspare Jacques. Two centuries later, after Olive's time, this is 2401, Gaspare, who is indeed named after the character that Olive created, works an uneventful job as a hotel detective in another moon colony. His prodigy sister, Zoe, who followed in their late mother's footsteps as a physicist, confides in him her research into Edwin, Vincent, and Olive's experiences of having swapped places, impossibly across centuries. Zoe believes that this anomaly supports the simulation hypothesis, their mother's field of research, if it represents data corruption in the simulation. Zoe admits that she works under strict secrecy at the Time Institute, a government agency wielding sole legal authority over time travel, which will officially investigate the anomaly. Impatient to escape this humdrum life, and despite warnings about the Institute's ruthless bureaucracy, Gaspare discovers a mutual friend at the Institute who is eager to recruit him to join the investigation. After years of training, he travels to the past to interview each possible witness of that anomaly. Because he is officially briefed on each interviewee's life and ultimate fate, he is warned that deliberately changing the past, however well-intentioned, is punishable by being forcibly stranded in the past. After uneventfully interviewing Alan Sammy, an elderly man who played the violin in Oklahoma City Airship Terminal, which is where the anomaly is supposedly taking place, Gaspare interviews Olive, also learning little. Knowing that she is about to die during an imminent global pandemic, he defies protocols and warns her to return home immediately. Trusting his warning, Olive avoids her fate and safely reunites with her family as the pandemic erupts. Zoe urges Gaspare to go on the lam, but he persuades her to help him continue investigating the anomaly, incriminating herself as well. He witnesses the anomaly at the same time as Vincent, then travels to 1918 to accomplish his true goal, to personally assure Edwin of his sanity, saving him from being committed to an insane asylum. Returning to the Time Institute, Gaspare is arrested alongside Zoe, but he does not regret his actions even upon learning that Edwin's ultimate death from the Spanish flu remains unchanged. Gaspare's punishment is carried out by forced time travel to 20th century Ohio, where, at the murder scene that Morella witnessed, he is framed and left to be arrested and sentenced to life in prison. Years later, Zoe, who has joined another organization with time travel technology, saves a 60-year-old Gaspare Jacques from his incarceration, bringing him to safe lodging near Oklahoma City in 2172. To evade the Time Institute, he receives a new identity and facial surgery, becoming Alan Sammy. He realized that he himself will cause the anomaly by the meeting of his past and future selves at the spaceport, because essentially what's causing the anomaly is three of him are in the same place at once. Decades later, having learned the violin and moved to Oklahoma City, Alan plays at the airship terminal on the destined day, seeing reality corrupt and repair itself as Edwin, Vincent, Olive, and his past selves all appear before him. And that is left the plot summary left a few things out, but in general, that's the plot of Sea of Tranquility. Stella, did you like this novel?
Yes, I liked it the first time. Like I said, I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads, which I don't do often. Like it really, for me, that really means something. And I think I would probably keep that with that particular rating. I really liked it. I did speed read it. I procrastinated this particular book, but speed read it. And I was like, oh, it's coming back to me, but I still had questions and everything. And it was very satisfying how everything tied together. So I kind of disagree with, that man,
yes,
who reviewed it negatively, to be honest. But yes, so I do like it.
I do too. It read quickly. In fact, I was doing questions for this episode. I ended up rereading like the back 30 pages this morning because I was looking for something and I was like, I'm gonna keep reading it. So I reread the ending of the book because it's that compelling to me. She really does character-driven story very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
I really was interested in every single character in this book. Now, of course, you have a couple of characters who I recognize right away because I'd read The Glass Hotel, and we'll talk about Vincent a little bit. But yeah, it was compelling. And I feel the same way about you, but I do have a question about that whole, what the person said in that review. But in the same way, I'm like, no, this really, really, really worked for me, and I really enjoyed it. And it is, as a couple of the reviewers said, it's intimate in some ways that you wouldn't expect like a time travel, like a vast time travel story like this to be. And I think she pulled that off really, not even pulled it off. She just did this really well.
Mm-hmm.
Pulled that off. It implies that she, shouldn't have tried or something.
Yeah.
So before we get into the book itself, but are you a time travel person as far as like, do you like really reading those stories, watching those movies? Did you like it in this book as well? And do you have like a favorite type or favorite travel story?
I mean, it'd probably be, I guess, Terminator.
oh, yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny because Harry Shute's mom hates anything to do with time travel. And it's like so absurd that it gets to the point of like Past Lives, which is a film that's nominated for Best Picture. I said, well, it has different timelines, but it's not shifting. It's just like the past and then the present and then like the future. And she's like, no, I don't do time travel. So I'm thinking about her with this particular one. I think it's, I think time travel is fine. It gets really complicated really quickly. And so I think that's why maybe I hesitate to say I love it and I'm like really deep diving in to do things with it. I'm trying to think, I should have looked over these questions before. Had you not asked me, I probably could have picked up on a time travel. I'm sure there's like a TV show.
Like Quantum Leap and stuff like that.
Yeah. I can't even think off the top of my head. But I mean, as comic book readers, you and I have probably really delved into a lot of time travel.
Yeah.
And of course, Avengers Endgame and all like that was really big. And just like the slipstream. And if you're messing things up, it's all very interesting. Actually, I will say, I don't know if this counts, but I really like The Butterfly Effect with Ashton Kutcher. I actually think that's a really good film that I would recommend to other people. And that is certainly something that, he keeps trying to change things and it has an effect and everything. I enjoy that. So I'll throw that out there. But yeah, it's just, I really have to think about it. It's not something that comes easily. And I think you can get lost in the weeds. And I also think that some people don't do it properly, mostly in terms of visual, I think, media. But with this, you know, I felt like everything worked out pretty well. Any sort of hiccup might have been at the very end, like explaining, oh, he was the cause of the anomaly. But otherwise, I feel like I probably just mostly stay away from them.
You know, I'm kind of like you were, like, you know, there are bad time travel stories out there, obviously. It's bad of anything of this subgenre. I like stuff that is of all types of shapes and sizes. Yeah, like very serious things, action oriented things like the Terminator. I think the Terminator and Terminator 2 as well are great, great movies. But then there's like funny, like I love Back to the Future. It's one of my favorite movies. And the sequels, I haven't watched the sequels in a very long time, part two and three, but I do remember enjoying the Back to the Future, the original one. Such a great time travel movie, played for laughs, of course. But then you have like more serious ones. There's an independent film from a number of years ago that called Primer, that is these like two guys creating this time travel device, and they're like, you know, like software engineers or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's really, really good, but it gets confusing very quickly. Like you need a flow chart to figure out who is who is what, because they keep going back to certain points. And it's it is one of those things where they had pledged, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to go back in time. We're going to be here, and we're only going to be here. And they start breaking their own rules, and then it just gets really, really messy. And I just remember, as confusing as it is, it's really compelling because it's really, really well done. So I would very much recommend Primer. And I haven't seen Looper. Yeah. So Days of Future Past. That's a great comic book story. I never saw the movie. The adaptation.
Yeah. Well, Looper, I did see
the movie. I did see the movie. It was all right. I haven't seen the one that came after it, Age of Apocalypse, I think.
Oh,
I didn't see that. And I didn't see Dark Phoenix. I stopped with that.
I didn't even connect when you said Rian Johnson, and then I read his name. I'm like, oh, Rian Johnson. Star Wars, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the same guy? Last Jedi. Okay. I'm like, isn't that the same guy?
Yeah. The Last Jedi. Yeah. So I'm not even gonna touch that landmine. You know how people are about that.
Oh, yeah.
For the record, I really like that movie. Here, I thought the time travel was fascinating, because she created two time periods in the future out of whole cloth, so she didn't have to keep jumping around our past. And I think that was one of the things that worked really well. And it seemed like she was trying to ground the worlds of the future in a very real, like very realistic sort of way. Like there are still some of the same problems on Earth and the moon and the outer colonies and things like that. And there's class issues, there's money issues. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very lived in world, as opposed to blinking into the future and all of a sudden it's the Jetsons, you know? So I really liked that about the way she set up the world in it.
I agree.
But the novel is, funny enough, it's like, it's about time travel, obviously, but it's also kind of about exile and how much of it you see is like people in exile or people fleeing something in some way or shape or form in this book.
I'm so sorry, I missed the question. I was listening, but what is
so how is this novel, as much as it's about time travel, how is this novel about exile or exiling yourself or leaving or being exiled?
Now I've got to think through our characters here. Yeah, I mean, it starts off with a pretty big exile. And it's interesting because each of the characters who are exiled or exile themselves are doing it potentially because of a moral quandary.
Mm-hmm.
And the repercussions of, I guess, maybe them speaking up. So, for example, our Edwin, he spoke up, basically being like, we're a bunch of colonizers.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, maybe the Indians, the Asian Indians have something to, you know, there's some truth behind their complaints. And so then he's kind of, yeah, an embarrassment to the family and pushed off. And later on, he's exiled too because of his insanity. But that changes slightly because of the time stream. Yeah. Vincent, because I'll go with Vincent a little bit. She, I would say a self-exile because of what happened with the Bernie Madoff sort of situation.
Yeah, that's in the Glass Hotel.
Yeah, so you can kind of revisit that a bit more. With Olive, that I don't think would be self-imposed. Obviously, she wrote this novel, but it was really only because of the previous pandemic kind of coming back into favor, and they're making a film, right, of it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like her second round of looking at this, and she has an agent. So really it's a prompting of others. It's not like she wants to leave her family. And I think you can kind of see the stress with her conversations with other people, as well as the communications between her and her husband. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, definitely. So there might not be a moral quandary there, but I think maybe it's almost an implicit or something that's put upon her by society because of the constant, why are you a woman and not with your child?
Yeah.
So there's that sort of thing associated with it. And of course with Gasparri, his exile occurs because he did have empathy. He had a lack of empathy,
yeah,
and ended up saving Olive. And so this of course caused him disaster. So yeah, it is a great way to potentially think about that. And then even tertiary characters, I think, like Talia, and her relationship with Night City, and then also having to leave because she was divulging secrets. I wonder how, I feel like that thematically it fits given this was written, I suppose during the pandemic and, you know, revisiting that time period because all of us were in this exile, whether it was self-imposed or it was placed upon
us.
And we were just separated from everybody. And we didn't want to be, and that was difficult. So I think thematically it fits, with what was going on at the time.
Yeah, that was kind of the we were obligated to talk about the coronavirus pandemic.
Right.
But you're right, it does have that. Of course, we see the flu pandemic kind of hit Earth in Olive's time. That's what she does escape. I think, and what's interesting is Mandel has a fascination with characters like this. If you go back to even Station 11, where some of them are in self-imposed exiles or they're cast out, or you have people who, like Vincent in the Glass Hotel, want to do something completely different with their lives. I think there's that paparazzi photographer in Station 11 whose name escapes me, who is like, I'm turning myself around at this point, you know, sort of. So there's characters who are just want to go in a different direction. She seems to be, she seems to really like those types of stories and characters. And I think she's really strong at writing them. Vincent's an interesting character. You mentioned how her life, she essentially dismantles and reassembles her life more than once in the Glass Hotel, because she's like working at a hotel. You know, she's in the hotel like with her brother, and then at one point she marries a Bernie Madoff type, and riding high on that, and his Ponzi scheme gets discovered, and really within almost overnight she's gone, and disappears, and she ends up working on a shipping freighter out in like the Pacific or something, and her disappearance is that she falls overboard at the end of at one point, and that's what people are investigating. That's what Morella is trying to figure out, whether or not that rumor is true. But you know, here you have in a similar way, Gasparri does, you know, he is forced out, and then his life is kind of rebuilt after his prison sentence with the help from his sister and two ladies on a farm, and we'll get to them in a minute. So she has a fascination with characters like this, and I think it works really well. But also, is it me, or does she have a thing for setting stories in hotels and airports? It's three novels. We've gotten hotels and we've gotten an airport.
Yeah, that is very true. Do you think this is just her life? But I mean, if Station 11, that was like the breakout for her. So it's not like she was, I feel like, experiencing too much travel as Olive was. But I mean, they are, if you think about it, rampant with diseases.
They are.
So I don't know if that's the best way. And it's like places where people are coming and going, you know, both formally as well as informally. And so anything could potentially happen, just like maybe a restaurant or something like that. But you're right. I didn't connect it until you said all that, but that is true.
Yeah. And it's interesting that Gaspari is like a hotel detective, which I think is like
watching.
Yeah. It watches people and keeps track of like, crimes and shoplifting and those sorts of like stealing and stuff like that. And like Talia, who is Talia is a childhood friend of his and who had just kind of disappeared, as a kid, moved away, and then they reunite in right before he goes to the Time Institute, because she's working at the same hotel. And then we find out that she's like actually selling secrets of the Time Institute and she's exiled. And at the end of the book, when he goes to Oklahoma and he has his face changed because he's living with these two older women, and living on this farm, and he becomes Alan. His sister had said, one of the things she had said, enjoy yourself and meet your neighbors. And at one point he does. And the woman who lived next door, who is also kind of a recluse, they opens the door and it's Talia, and they end up marrying and they spend some time together as man and wife. And she passes away, and like, he starts to put it together as that he's the person with the violin in the airport as his life goes on. And he remembers his interview with that guy years ago. It is interesting how it is like these people who come and go, and these airports and hotels and stuff. And I think it's the transitory nature of it really, really works for this especially. But what I pointed out earlier in the our discussion, when I was talking about the world she sets up, there's two moon colonies that are featured. There's like Moon 1 and Moon 2 or whatever. I can't remember what the official names are, but one is called Night City because the electricity or the simulation on the dome over it where it would simulate day and night broke ages before and nobody fixed it, so that city is in permanent night, and there seems to be a class difference between the two. Like, that's the poorer, the less desirable moon colony, and the other one is the bright shining, the more upper class, the richer one, etc. And I thought that was interesting. So what do you think led her to have that be part of the book, as well as like the bureaucracy of the Time Institute, as opposed to just, we've moved past these things as a society, which some futuristic novels tend to do?
Yeah, I feel like, we've had this discussion potentially with maybe some utopia or dystopian novels that we've talked about, that everyone wants to, and we can sit here and really want things to turn around, be better for future generations. But I think it's just like history really is cyclical, as I think we're seeing even right now. And I think it might be silly. Like, I would love for it to be true, but I think it's silly to think that everything will be solved if we're just setting up new colonies, because people are people. So they're going to be people in, and that's not always the best. So I feel like, issues are going to be carried over. And I love that Gaspari, walked by her, because I think it seemed like they were wealthier on the wealthier side, but he would walk past her house because he knew which Talia used to live. Her family used to live in Olive's house. And they had like a conversation in the lunch line or something, and kind of got to, I guess, communicate about, you know, how they are in different social standings, but they seem to have more in common. I think she said, like, she likes to go into the woods or something like that. But, gee, what was my point? I think your question was, why do it and not?
Yeah, why have all that be part of the book as opposed to making a society in which we've moved past those things,
yeah,
because we've evolved socially.
I'm trying to think about all the characters. I feel like all the characters are in different places in their lives, which makes, mm-hmm, which I appreciate the diversity. I think with Talia, I don't know, even spilling the tea,
espionage,
I know, whatever she's doing, I feel like that's almost a way, given what her social standing was, I feel like that's kind of a way to get back at the Time Institute and bureaucracy in general. Yeah, I guess my main answer would be because I think it's more realistic that we would take those particular problems with us wherever we would go. And I think it just creates a diverse cast that everyone has these interesting backgrounds. And maybe she wants her characters to be more virtuous, especially the main ones, because, like I said, Edwin is someone who's like speaking up against colonization. Mm-hmm. Gasperi has empathy. His sister also has empathy, but obviously she struggles with it a bit more, which is why she knows she can't go back and do traveling anymore. And then Olive, I think, struggles with kind of her place as a mother. So I don't know. It just seems realistic. And I think that it gives our author gives the characters some virtues as well as some struggles too, so that they are relatable.
Yeah. And in the far future, the 2401, where Gasperi's from, they have put colonies on other planets as well. They don't specify what, but they say they're the far colonies. And Zoe was out there at one point and says she's got tired of living underground. Yeah. I don't know if that is a literal thing, that they literally were living underground and that's what the far colonies are like, or if it was figurative because she was avoiding, you know, the Time Institute and she was working for another company, you know, so like, was she underground in terms of like, you know, living on the lam type of thing, in secret. But it is interesting. And the other thing is that it doesn't go past the moon. You know, there's mention of far colonies, but there's no mention of space travel beyond our solar system. There's no mention of alien races. You know, that's not, mm-hmm, I love Star Trek, but this isn't Star Trek, you know? And, she has an intimate story with these characters. And she keeps the setting, as much as she sets up the world of the moon colony, she keeps it so tight and on where these people are. So we don't have like a vast idea of everything. And I always loved Talia and Gasperi, especially their relationship in the past as kids, because they used to like walk out essentially into the woods and kind of, I think, go up to like the edge of the colony and things like that. And it was a sort of, you could see her rebellious streak even from her time as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he remembers the most when he sees her again, and then sees her again in the future. Of course, it's like, of course you're here. You know, it just, it all clicks together for him. And I think that she's a great, great catalyst for that.
Yeah, she has such a small part, but I feel like she makes such an impact. And this book isn't really, it's not a romance at all.
No.
But I always get like a little bit of a shipper thrill at that part where he just walks over because he's ostensibly going to take violin lessons. And she opens the door and his face has already been changed.
Yeah.
And says, "Hello, Gasperi." And it's just like, oh, this is great. And the fact that they get married less than a year later.
Yeah.
But how also sad that he knows, you know, exactly when his wife is going to die, or, you know, in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind of ironic considering he told two people that he knew two other people when how they were going to die or what their fate was, and he warned them against it. And Edwin died the same way, but he mm-hmm. got him out of an asylum, and all, we don't know what Alla's final fate was. I think she just lived and eventually passed away. But she avoided the plague. He knows that Tali is going to die, and he has an idea of when, but at this point he has accepted something about it that he hadn't accepted prior. Is it a lesson learned, or is it that this feels right for her, or what do you make of the fact that he doesn't tell her how she's gonna die and all that, as he did with Olive?
Good question. Yeah. Because he can't do anything to fix it. Mm-hmm. With Olive, that was a preventative measure, and that was something that he could do. But I think with Talia, it's more like you're telling someone. So then it's just going to be a bunch of paranoia and not really, I think, spending the time together and living in the moment. So I think in that way, it would not have served either of them, honestly.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. Because she does go through a lot of those sections pretty quickly in the book and that life together. You wonder about, did he experience the grief before her death?
Mm.
Privately, secretly, because he knew. How does one go through that emotionally? I don't know if that's the case. That would be something you'd explore in this book, or be an interesting thing to explore in a book. You know this person is going to pass away. You have nothing to do with it. Yeah. You have nothing you can do about it. Do you grieve before they die? And does that have a different, does the death have a different effect in you and things like that?
That's a great question. I feel like it's kind of this thing of anticipatory dread. I feel like Taylor Reid did this really well, the author of Daisy Jones, of course, Evelyn Hugo, because her main love interest, which I would love for you to read that book, so I won't spoil anything, but her main love interest explains she's basically at the end of her life. And I think in that moment of when she tells Evelyn, that Evelyn mourns then, but everything else is them spending time together. So I think you have to mourn initially so that you can live, because if every day is grief, you are not living your life with them. And I think that that's a disservice to both of you and to your relationship and everything. But that's a great question.
Yeah. And the other thing I noticed too, we were talking about Mirella and Talia. They keep running into each other in the case of Mirella, it's through time, because she encounters him in the future. Then, as an adult, and she recognizes him as this guy from when she was a kid. And then at the end of the novel, he's eventually exiled to Ohio, and he's framed for this murder that she witnessed. And then Talia, I already mentioned, three times over the course of it. So there's something about people who orbit your life that seem to come back around. And I wonder what she is saying about those type of people and how they are important, or are they important to us?
It's interesting you mentioned Mariella, because I feel like she was the weakest character.
Mm-hmm.
And by weakest, I mean maybe the least developed. I don't know if that was intentional or her space was given to somebody else.
Possibly.
But we just don't, we kind of see her, and her story reminds me of somebody's that I just can't, it kind of reminds me of Therese, to be honest.
Okay.
Where she's just with this one person, and then she decides not to be with that person anymore. And we find out later through another character that she ends up moving overseas and finding somebody and marrying them and having children. You remember? Yeah. So it's just we don't even find out through her. It's through, I guess it was Gasperi, maybe, or he was checking records, maybe. I don't know. People in the orbit. I feel like that makes sense, though, doesn't it? That people kind of pop up in your life at times that you may not expect them to pop up. I feel like with any relationship that you have, whether it's friendship or a romantic relationship, whether any of these things work out, that once that ends or you leave it or something happens, maybe it just like peters out, that you've learned something from that. I think you have to take something from it and you grow from it and you take it to your new relationship, or future friendships or something like that. And so just like with friendships, you know, if friendships end and that person comes back, then hopefully you would know, like, well, this didn't work out the first time. If you're willing to give it a go again, then you can kind of try to repair from that. But yeah, I feel, you know, life is weird, but also the world is small, you know, it's a small world, because literally, you know, someone will pop up and I'll find out that I'm like connected to this other person. I'm like, that's so weird. That
it is strange.
True. And that happens for real. Like, I can't think of what it recently happened to me, but I can't put my finger on what the example is. But I feel like that's potentially another thing that she's saying as well, that even though we have Earth, we have two colonies, we have the far colonies that are starting to be created. So it seems like, wow, it's really vast, our civilization, we're really spread out, that we're still connected to each other, which I think is also a very beautiful thing in terms of COVID again, because some people had a really tough time, you know, if you're by yourself, or if you might be in a bad situation with a partner or with family. And I think it was incumbent upon maybe the stronger of us to reach out and look out after those people and check in on them and everything. And so I think human connection is really important, no matter how spread out you are.
Yeah. And he connects with others too. Like Zoe, the relationship between him and Zoe becomes stronger over the course of the book, to the point where she not only agrees to commit a crime with him, but then breaks him out of jail and sets him up. She says, "You would have done the same thing for me." And he, in his mind, he's like, "I don't know if I would have," but the way she does that, where she prior to that was he was the emotional, empathetic one, and she was the practical one. It was like kind of that back and forth. You could see how she has developed, and she has kind of learned that sort of, or unlocked that, because maybe that empathy was already there, or always there, but she unlocks it in some way.
I will say, I feel like he didn't have the ability. He wouldn't have had the ability to help her, mm-hmm. rather than the capacity to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Or did you read that differently? Because when he said like that he wouldn't have been able to, I feel, because he's not as intelligent as she is, and he didn't have kind of the tools that would be necessary. So I took it as he would love to be able to do that, but he would not have been able to.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Morella, by the way, because I think she is in the Glass Hotel. So I think her story is a little bit more detailed, but we get her future in the moment where we see the conversation between him and Vincent about the anomaly. And then he's just kind of like, he hesitates Gasparri had hesitated by the men's room door for a moment, watching the party, and his happiness faded. And he says that here was the awfulness that Zoe had warned him of the utterly miserable knowledge of how everyone else's story would end. So he goes into Vincent's, because this takes place 14 months before her husband is arrested for running the Ponzi scheme. And then she lives for another 12 years and dies on the deck of by falling off the deck of the container ship. Mm-hmm. Morella, he talks about how her husband was an investor in the fraud scheme. He loses everything, as would all of the family members he got to invest, and he dies by suicide. She finds the body in the note. And then in March of 2020, she travels to Dubai for unknown reasons, arriving just in time to be stranded by the COVID-19 pandemic. She marries a guy named Himesh Cheng, and they survive the pandemic, marry, and live out the rest of their lives together. She has three children, a successful career in retail management, and dies of pneumonia at age 85. So he just kind of summarizes it for us, which, again, she's like a tertiary character who serves the function of that, you know, she recognizes him from earlier, and then it kind of comes around at the end where he sees her as a child. So maybe she could have developed her a little more, but I don't know how necessary it was. Let's talk about his empathy, his morality, his sense of ethics, and really, are there ethics to time travel? The bureaucracy seems to think so. Yeah. But, you know, like you said, you'd have too much empathy to let people to their fates. You know, how does he apply his own morality and sense of ethics? Was it there, or does it develop? How dangerous is that? You know, what do you make of all of that?
So I think there are ethics with time travel. I do understand and agree that you should probably not be messing with things, because as we learned from Ashton Kutcher, things then get out of control in the present / future. That is then they could be real bad. So even if you've messed up just a little tiny thing. So I think that the Time Institute looks for, even though the way it's presented is they only get mad if it messes up the Time Institute. So I don't know how concerned they are about humanity necessarily, but I think time travel overall, some people just look at this one thing, which is what Gaspari did. Like, he was with Olive. He knows about her. He knows that she's going to die and, you know, she'll not be able to see her family again.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to zoom out and see the big picture. Like, oh, well, what is the end result of that? In her case, I don't think anything shifted. I think everything was okay. I think even when he went to talk to Edwin so that he wouldn't spend his final days in the insane asylum, he died, like, I think there's like a 24-hour difference. It was just like the location of his death changed. So I think overall we do need to be careful about, as if, you know, time travel is real. It might be at some point. We do need to be careful about what we are messing with, and I think that's how, you know, empathy can sometimes get us into trouble, and so that might be it. But I approve of this, what he did with all, because that would have been hard to sit there and do it. I don't know how you how do you work there? Is this like a social worker? Because I've noticed that social workers, they've got to have emotions of steel, because it's not helping anyone if someone is being emotional and telling you their emotional trauma and you're also getting emotional. You're not supposed to do that. So I mean, do you need to be that way, or are time travelers sociopaths? I think that's what it is. That has no empathy. I don't know, but it seems like at least three characters that we knew of the four named entities at, because Ephraim, it doesn't seem to have empathy. No. We've got Gaspari, of course, his sister, his sister's love interest, which I can't tell if it's the same person as the one who used the cat to come back. I don't know if that's the same person or if it's a separate story, but so three, like a huge percent of the people can't do this job because it's too effective, of their emotions. So, does that answer your question?
I think it does. And I think I take it more of the social worker angle, for some of them, and maybe the sociopath for others, depending on what, and maybe they hire them for different missions based on their profile. So I imagine, because the Time Institute is very, very secretive, kind of like the NSC or the CIA or something, you know, that you're working for a branch that is essentially like, you know, you have to pretend you don't work for them. And there's, what's interesting to me too, is that at the end, when Zoe comes back, she says their Time Institute isn't the only group of people with time travel technology. So there's competition that can get dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very possible in the world she set up, because she set up a world that is a lot like ours. It's just in the future. And we have seen the sort of, like you said, history is cyclical. It rhymes. So we're seeing those rhymes. Governments compete with one another. Corporations compete with one another. Corporations do terrible things to get ahead in their mission and their profits. Governments will do that. The more people you have with this technology, if they're competing with each other in some way, the time stream itself is going to be really more affected than any of them can possibly control. And of course, I'm extrapolating, right? You know, this doesn't, we don't see this happening in the novel, but I think there's an implication there that it could be worse than it is at the moment. And I think that some of the ethics that the Time Institute has as far as time travel makes sense. I mean, I think you're right about not changing the past, but even then, nothing he does causes a ripple or anomaly in time. The anomaly in time is him because of his investigation, not because of telling Olive that she's going to die, you know? But Mandel, when you do a time travel novel, you have to set up your own rules, right? You know, there's certain things that you can play with that, or there are certain things about time travel that like are kind of universal, like the idea that if you change whatever you change in the past will have an effect in the future, you know, that sort of thing. But you can also set up like your own rules, your own ideas, and then you could break them if you need to. Does she do that well? Does she break any of her own rules as far as the time travel in the novel is concerned about how things work or don't work?
I think the only time we could say that there might be some confusion is the explanation of the anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
At least there are two Gasparis existing in one moment. Does that cause the anomaly? Or is it because then it goes on further and it's like, but there's also a Gaspari existing in the forest with Vincent.
Yeah.
And in the forest with Edwin. And
so it's like four of them, right?
Yes. But they're not at the same time. So that's why I don't know that, why would it create an anomaly if there are hundreds of years apart? Does that make sense? That's the only thing that I get stuck on.
It's like it's caught in its own weird loop. The anomaly, I think, is taking place at the airport in Oklahoma City. And where we see it in the past is a ripple effect. And it's almost like it's its own like self-fulfilling prophecy. Kind of like what they call the grandfather paradox, where the Terminator is a great example of this, where John Connor sends his own father back in time to meet his mother. You know, like, how does that happen?
Yeah.
Like, if John Connor was like, but you accepted his truth. And I think it's a similar thing here that, like, you know, there's this anomaly of all these different people. And it makes total sense that him existing in four different times, but at the same place, would cause essentially like feedback, you know, static interference or feedback.
Yeah.
Because it is kind of breaking the time rules. There was just to go back to comic books. There was a rule it's mentioned in more than once in Silver Age and Bronze Age DC comics, but it's especially mentioned at the end of the first part of the Superman story, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, where Supergirl comes back to visit him with the Legion of Superheroes. And in that time, in the present where she is visiting, Supergirl's dead. And because it's after the Crisis on Infinite Earths. So Supergirl says, I know we can't be at the same time. We can't, like, I can't, if I'm here, she's somewhere else. I'm somewhere else in another time because I can't be in the same part of the timeline as her. And he's like, yes, she's off on a mission in the past or something to cover for the fact that, you know, you're dead. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to let you know. So the idea that you cannot simultaneously exist makes sense because it really messes with things. Now, Back to the Future, for instance, does not play with that in that way because Marty's following himself around in part two, you know, and Biff goes to talk to his past self because he gives him Gray Sports Almanac, et cetera, et cetera. So you can have it happen and work. But I like the fact that she does it here, and it causes, like I said, what's essentially feedback. And Zoe thinks it's a simulation, this little simulation theory that we're all living in a simulation and et cetera, like the Matrix. But I think this actually proves the opposite, that it's just the time stream being hurt a little bit, but it seems to correct itself, right? It's not like it has such a ripple effect that it, things collapse in on themselves or something.
But the anomaly is always there, right? Like, yes. You can't. Okay. Yeah. And even after him as Sammy dies, it'll still be there.
Yeah. It's like now it's established. So it's kind of like running, you know, it's like you turn the TV off and you turn the thing on and the program is still going. It's just, it's always going to be like that. And maybe because it is that, and that's that is what it is, and that's its function, it is actually now therefore stable because it's just this thing cycling through.
Yeah.
And it is really, really weird, but it's not growing and it's not getting worse. So it's contained. And I think
Does that mean though that people still think they're in a simulation for all time because they don't figure it out?
Well, possibly. I mean, people, like her mother was trying to research that. So I'm sure that there are people who would believe that, you know? And there are people who would not believe, you know, in the same way we have believers and non-believers of different faiths, there are people in this country who do not believe in actual science. So I would imagine that in the future, in the future, there are people who do believe in a simulation theory, but there are also people who do believe time travel is possible. And then there are people who believe in none of this crap you're wrong about all this crap. And we're just here where we are. So I think that, there certainly could be, you know, there's enough people in the world for different points of view to exist. We will get to the end in a little bit. You talked about Ephraim a little bit. There is a really interesting passage, though, with Ephraim. It's on page, do you have the hardcover?
I do.
Okay. It's on page 103 to 105.
It's, is it about him not making his quota?
No, it's okay. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Now, the phrase "no star burns forever" shows up quite a bit, but he says, you know, "no star burns forever." This is Gaspari's narration. You can say it is the end of the world and mean it, but what's get lost in that kind of careless usage is that the world will eventually literally end, not civilization, whatever that is, but the actual planet. Which is not to say that those smaller endings aren't annihilating. A year before I began my training at the Time Institute, I went to a dinner party at my friend Ephraim's place. Because I think Ephraim's the one who kind of helps get him in. And then Ephraim ends up being kind of, there's no villain in this story, but he's the closest thing to, you know, because he's the one that doles out the punishment, essentially. So Ephraim has this story about going on a walk in a cemetery with his daughter Mei Ying, who was 4 at that time, and Ephraim was an arborist. And I think he even asks Ephraim when he's at the Time Institute, what about your arborist? He's like, yeah, I kind of do that sometimes, but you can tell that he's a little bit more engulfed in his job. Mm-hmm. But then they found the grave of another 4-year-old girl, Ephraim told me, and he just wanted to leave after that. He was used to graveyards. He sought them out. He'd always said he didn't find them depressing, just peaceful. But that one grave just got to him. He looked at it, and it was unbearably sad. Also, it was the worst kind of earth summer day, impossibly humid, and he felt like he couldn't get enough air. We can relate to that in Charlottesville. The drone of the cicadas was oppressive. Sweat ran down his back. He told his daughter it was time to go, but she lingered by the gravestone for a moment. If her parents loved her, Mei Ying said, it would have felt like the end of the world. It was such an eerily astute observation, Ephraim told me, that he stood there staring at her and found himself thinking, where did you come from? They got out of the cemetery with difficulty. She had to stop and inspect every goddamn flower and pine cone, he said, and never went back. And that line stuck with me as I was reading it. If her parents loved her, it would have felt like the end of the world. Why do you think Gaspari's telling us that story?
I don't know about the child necessarily, but I feel like it connects with the grief that we were talking about in terms of Olive dying and her family mourning her. And then Gaspari later on, though I guess at this particular time, maybe he would not have known that yet, that his wife would die.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's to show. I mean, when he says that she stopped to check out every Judy flower, just like, my gosh, she's a child. Why are you going to be so upset? I feel like it gives us a good portrait of who Ephraim is, too. And also just that children are sometimes very astute. Mm-hmm. And I think we underestimate them sometimes. What do you think?
I think your point about Ephraim is really good, because he's kind of annoyed by it, right? He's just like, where the hell do you come from? And then, and in a sense that he's more puzzled than he's annoyed. Like, he had to check out a flower. We never went back to the cemetery. Whereas I read that and I'm like, that is profound and sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would have been worried, but also just like touched, because, kid, you know, it's also a very kid thing to say in that profound sort of way. I think you're right. It does clue you into his character. I think it is also something about what we talk about grief and how different people react to the grief in their lives in this novel. Because Mirella eventually moves on from her husband dying and marries the guy and, you know, and lives a long life. And you talked about Olive in a moment. And then we were just talking about, how does Gaspar deal with knowing that Talia will die? And that sort of thing. So it's, I think it's just one more contemplation about grief. You know, could you wonder, could it not be, it would feel like the end of the world, but maybe it isn't the end of the world, and it need, you can move on until the world does eventually, but the world will eventually end.
And it seems at that time too, that a lot of things were preventative or preventable, because Gaspar, when he's in jail, he's like, this, I'm having a heart condition, but this is going to be cured. And then when they talk about the pandemic that Olive gets, that dies in, they said that was like SARS-4 that you got. It was one of your childhood inoculations. So it seems even more tragic that everything is, it seems to be preventable. Mm-hmm. And yet we've lost a 4-year-old.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, that is very realistic.
Of course.
That, especially in today's world, where people are by choice or by circumstance, whatever, you know, are dying in ways that are preventable.
Mm.
And so I felt that, as sad as it is, I felt that was a very realistic, like one of those more realistic elements of the future, that of the present that she put in the future. Is sentencing time criminals to be forcibly stranded in the past, and in Gaspar's case, framed for murder, hypocrisy or irony on the part of the Time Institute, since they're so strict about maintaining the timeline?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, they had it, I believe it was stated in there, I don't think I'm coming up with this, but they have certain things that they kind of hold on to for that purpose.
Mm.
I was trying to think, gosh, is this like the death penalty technically?
Kind of.
I know, because they're like never gonna get back. Because I feel like exile in a time period is different than you're in jail and in a time period that's not your own. Is it hypocrisy or irony?
I know you like calling people hypocrites.
I do like calling people hypocrites. They did mess with it because of Mirella. So I guess there's a tinge of both. Let's go with some hypocrisy.
Which I've never heard of that happening in a bureaucratic government organization. Have you?
Yeah.
So again, I think it is. And I think that is very right, because there is a sense of superiority among the Time Institute people. Ephraim, for instance, that they are above, better than, that they are the authority on this, and this is the punishment for going against that authority. Now I have a couple of questions about the end of the book. One of the criticisms that I read off, and I'm scrolling back up to the just to refresh everybody's memory from about an hour ago, was Constance Grady for Vox saying that in her mind, quote, the different sections of this novel are linked by a time travel mystery, and the mystery's resolution is so pat and cliched that if she were to describe the setup, one would immediately know how it all worked out. So my question is, do you think she's right? Do you think that's true? If so, is it cliche? Does Mandel make it work anyway?
Wow, I thought that was a man. So I apologize for misgendering the author of that.
Yeah, but don't apologize for coming down on men because...
Article. Well, you said it was a woman, though, so I apologize for...
I'm not going to get into like how many times I've read male reviews of female books or movies or music that are so drenched with misogyny. Anyway, okay, so but yes, is it cliche? Does she make it work? I mean, like, what do you think about?
I don't think it's cliche. So this is one. Some of these peoples annoy me. I'm going to throw out the P word, pretentious, because when I am enjoying something and like something shocking happens and someone says to me, I saw that coming. It was clear it was going to happen. It grates on my nerves. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, just keep it to yourself. Okay. I was trying to look up Pat to see what this word's drawing attention. No.
Mold. Oh, it's kind of...
How would you describe that?
Oh, it's...
Because none of this... That's not a pat on the back.
No.
None of it's good.
Let me look it up. It's...
simple and somewhat glib or unconvincing? Yes,
a pat ending.
Okay.
Yeah.
Simple and somewhat glib. I don't think so. Like I said, because I was... Even the second time, because I fully did not remember what had happened until I started tracking through, I was invested. I would say I'm most invested in Gaspari, whoever this guy is. And he's a complete mystery for a while until you get into the Bad Chickens timeline. And again, you know, having that door open with Talia and her just saying Gaspari is just like, oh, it's a swoonery moment.
Yeah.
And I don't find that to be simple, glib, or unconvincing. And we don't know how, I don't know if this person just saw that interaction between Gaspari and Morella and was like, oh, I know what's going to happen. He's a time traveler and he's the one who caused the anomaly. Like, how could you get any of that from one thing unless you're just an idiot savant? So I personally don't think so. I think everything works really well and it's tied together. And I think there aren't any loose ends. But I did not see like how the ending was going to happen, that he was going to be meeting himself, that the violinist was himself. And especially when you get into the fact when you hear Sammy actually verbalizing internally what he's doing and why he's doing it, like calling him son because he doesn't like that. Bringing up his dead wife because it focuses on the fact that Gaspari has a failed marriage. Focusing on his lingering issues with dialects and accents because he's self-conscious about that. I mean, I thought that was like really clever. Like, oh, of course. And because that's a way for Gaspari not to have an aha moment or look too closely and be like, oh my gosh, you're me. Because everything's
throwing
is kind
him
of,
off the scent.
Yeah, absolutely. Intellectually as well as emotionally. So I really disagree with the writer of that particular review.
I do too. It reeks of the cynicism of I'm smarter than the actual author. So we see that with movies all the time. Why didn't they just do this? Or I knew that was going to happen. I will say that when we got to the point where I realized that he was like, I realized what the ending would be, which was as we were getting to the ending and he was starting to realize it. My thought was, of course it's like this, but it felt really satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea that at the end, the person of the mystery at the center of the mystery you're investigating in a time travel movie is you is not exclusively hers, right? There are other stories like that. There are other things like that that happen. So it's a trope. And I think she nailed it. That's the thing. I like the fact that she did take tropes that are common to this time travel science fiction subgenre and she played with them. So she took things and elements of time travel and these types of stories that we're familiar with, and that in some cases could be cliches, and did something with them. And in my mind, it was satisfying. I was the same way with Talia opening the door and seeing him, because I was curious as to what had happened to her. And I was like, it was just, again, it was very sweet. And I liked that. I liked that the ending was, it wasn't happy. It was bittersweet. It was melancholy in some ways, but it felt whole. And I think that was, and the other thing is, the center of this book is not a mystery. The center of this book is the characters. Yes, the mystery drives the plot, but the anomaly is the MacGuffin. And honestly, by the time we get to what the anomaly is, I've been so invested in the characters, I'm not as concerned with figuring out the anomaly. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I was more invested in Olive and Victor, and I really liked the character Victor. I liked her in Vincent. I really liked the character Vincent. I liked her in The Glass Hotel, and I liked her in this. I was in Edwin and Gatsby, like all these characters and all these people who cross paths with one another, that this was just the way to move the plot along, and it was fine with me. And so when it comes to the end and he's like the person, I'm like, that is great. And she made that work in a way that a lesser writer would have made it pat and would have made it cheesy, you know. But this isn't like a mystery movie or something where, you know, once you find out the twist at the end, it you can never go back and reread it. I would totally go back and reread this because the characters are just that good.
I still am like, what actually happened to Vincent? Did she actually fall off?
She does, yeah. Well, you read The Glass Hotel, right?
I did, but even in that book, I felt like it was ambiguous as to what actually happened.
It would be interesting if she hadn't, and it would be interesting to hear Mandel tell that story.
Yeah.
Because it is a little bit, it is kind of ambiguous. But it also speaks to kind of the randomness of death sometimes, which I thought was pretty cool.
It's true. Yeah.
So maybe we'll check out the book some other time in another episode, because it is, I really didn't.
Next month on.
Okay. So my only other question about the ending, because I think you and I both really covered that, and I thought you summed it up really, really well. You had a lot of the same feelings that I did when I was reading that. My other question is, at what point did you think that Zoe figured out that Gaspar is the anomaly?
At one point, did who figure out?
Zoe. I think Zoe figured it all out. Because she sets it up.
Yeah.
When do you think she figured it out?
I wonder if after he was sent to Ohio. Because was immediately arrested, wasn't she? Or immediately reprimanded. And then it just took a long time for her to get to a place where she could actually work with a time machine, and she had a big ask because she was in the far colonies, right?
Yeah.
It was like, I'll work for you if I can do this, and couldn't go back until a certain time. So I feel like pretty quickly, but I think he was gone. I think he was out of the picture by the time she figured it out.
I think you're right. She had known, I think she knew all the details of all of his missions, and more than likely knew the thing about Morella, and the two encounters. So maybe she did start. And she's, you know, she was the smart one. So if anybody is going to figure this out, it's going to be her.
Yeah.
So again, the fact that, and she doesn't say, and that's what I liked. She doesn't say she knows anything about it. She just simply sets him up, and it's like, this is just to help you. You know, this is to give you a life that is not rotting in a prison cell. And then she's setting that up. Maybe in the back of her mind, she knows it's setting him up. But at the same time, maybe she knows that there's no problem with it, right? That she knows that time is not going to self-destruct. But this is actually the fate that has been chosen for him. So... I thought that was, it took me a while to realize that too. Because when I was rereading it, I was like, wait a second. She knew. And I thought, yeah. I was like, okay. So I liked how that's implied and not overt.
Yeah, because she said, check out your neighbors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing where he figures out, oh, really? And of all the characters in the novel who's going to figure it out, it's her.
Yeah.
Because she's the... Yeah. We talked about human connection. We talked about science and ethics. What about fate? Does she have a theme or point in this novel about fate?
Ooh.
Last question before the last question.
Wow, interesting. Does she have a statement to make about fate? Geez. I guess that it exists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think if free will exists in this particular novel. Because if Gasparri had let all of go, then the anomaly would not have happened.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So. Yeah, I don't know. We're a slave to our fate, potentially. And yeah, that
according to the Greeks.
Yeah. And even we feel like we're exercising free will, but then yeah, I kind of just have to lean into it. Because in the end, I mean, it was because Gasparri even was like, oh yeah, we're 23 years from now, I'll see Sammy, won't I? And Zoe's like, yep.
Yep.
And so, and then he did it. He got his plastic surgery, and because he could have gotten different plastic surgery, but he decided to get that man's plastic surgery. So yeah, I guess in this case, does anyone try to go against their fate? I don't know.
He does try to change other people's fates. I wonder if symbolically the anomaly is free will fighting against fate. That's the English teacher posit, but
yeah,
it's I just find it interesting how the fate worked itself out, but it's not in an Oedipus sort of way, you know, or like a terrible fate sort of way.
Yeah. So
is this required reading?
Oh, that was the last question. I think it is. I think it would give an interesting look into time travel and some of these ethical dilemmas for kids that I don't know necessarily. I know Slaughterhouse-Five is kind of something that may get into that. It's been so long since I've read that.
I haven't read that in like 25 years.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe this would be something that is more engaging for the kiddos. So, yes, I'm going to say yes.
I'm going to agree with you. I really liked this. I think alongside Station 11, this is another one of hers that is required reading. And I think that you really should check it out, especially if you like science fiction, if you like character pieces and time travel, because it really is it's a beautifully written book and everything is just compelling. And she does a lot in a little bit of space too, which is I really admire in a writer. You know, it's not a very long book.
No. And some of the chapters are
and it's
very short.
And yeah, it's 255 pages. Some of the chapters are very short. Her prose is succinct in places. And it's one of the great things about it, too. I think it really, really works. So, all right. So we have two Facebook comments. I'm going to have you read the Robert Ward one and I'll read the Gene Hendricks one.
Robert Ward, you say?
Yes.
Okay. Given the dismissal of Beowulf, is there any other fiction? I think I was the only
one.
Both
of these comments are about Beowulf, yeah.
Oh, okay. But I think that you liked it better.
Oh,
than
I love Beowulf, yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's really, yeah, they're both coming after me.
They're both coming after you.
Given the dismissal of Beowulf, is there any other fictional or real ancient heroes besides Greek or Roman that you do appreciate? Gilgamesh, accounts of Alexander the Great, etc. Don Quixote?
Yeah. I've never read Gilgamesh.
Well, he's saying ancient heroes, though. I don't know. You know, I do like some good Herodotus, but it's like, how am I just going to like throw out people? And any of the Roman people are very interesting to, of though the word mm-hmm. hero, you have to be kind of careful with that. I've not read Gilgamesh. I've not read Sir Gawain, and though I would like to read that and then see the film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. I guess not. I can't think of anything.
My knowledge of Alexander the Great is cursory. I remember stuff from world history classes back in high school, right? I would say beyond the Greek and Roman, the Arthurian legend, I really, yeah. really enjoy diving into that because there's so many different ways that story is told. You know, you could get really lost in it. And I think it's a really, really rich story. So, all right. So, Gene Hendricks, who is of the Two True Freaks Network, he's hosted a number of podcasts. The Hammer Strikes is one that's really good. Has comments on Beowulf. So he says, to Stella's comments about Beowulf being boring as a character, right? He says, consider him like Superman. He's an ideal to strive for when compared to the Anglo-Saxon / North gods, such as Odin, who no one should try to emulate. Yeah, kind of like Zeus, right? You know, like you don't want to emulate those guys. You need a hero like Beowulf to show that people can be strong and confident, but still loyal and not willing to come into another's kingdom and take over, much like the examples of Galahad and Percival that Tom mentioned. Essentially, Beowulf exemplified much of the Havamal. I don't think that's pronounced correctly, but I'll do my best. Think of it like a heathen Ten Commandments. The reason that others might not like him could be jealousy that they don't measure up. And there's a link to that. As far as the Christianity aspect is concerned, my theory is that whoever the author was, they took an existing story and recontextualized it to make it Christian. We were talking about this in the episode about how there's a lot of Christian references in Beowulf, but there are like, they're like pagan. And I had said that, you know, Christianity appropriated a lot of things over the centuries to make it easier for them to integrate get the pagan tribes to convert. The Christmas tree is like one of the best examples of it. So he said, my theory is whoever did it, they recontextualized it to make it Christian. You just need to look at Snorri Sturluson to see how that works. The tale of Jesus is a Viking warrior chief, aka the Heliand, is another example of this. We need to make our religion more palatable to get converts' view of things, much like Christmas. So yeah, so those were his comments about Beowulf. I thought they were pretty insightful. You know, Gene actually is somebody who follows the heathen religion as it is. Is really, really love. It's a great deep knowledge of Norse mythology. He's also like really knowledgeable about the Arthurian stuff too. So he's always a good conversation about that. So I did appreciate him mailing in or commenting on that. Any other words about Beowulf?
No, okay. No one's going for. No one picked up my hashtag Gaowulf though.
No.
That's sad.
No,
we didn't get. No one even talked about. Yeah. Whether he has a relationship with that man.
Mm.
Are you disappointed?
Yeah. I think you read too many Greek and Romans.
Is this toxic Norseman masculinity? They're not willing to be sensitive. Okay.
Anyway. So feel free to email us about any of these things or leave comments, especially about this episode. But before we go, we need to know what we're reading for next episode. So Stella, what's your pick?
Well, Stella did her due diligence. Remember during the Prez assault,
mm-hmm.
I found out an unfortunate thing about the author and thought, yes. Oh no, I should do pre-research. So I actually wanted to read a YA apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic novel because I thought, well, we were kind of talking about it with, it was like, this was very meta in some of the conversations, even her interviews and things actually talking about the genre coming back up again. I was like, let's read one. And so I thought, I've never read this one series. And so I, well, let me check out the author first. charges of sexual harassment.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, we're not doing that. But I did find one. We're going back to my time in ninth grade, freshman year of high school. We're going to read Alas Babylon by Pat Frank.
All right. And that is Alas, A-L-A-S?
Correct. Comma, okay. Babylon.
All right. Yeah, so come back in a month for that. In the meantime, send us, share us, and all the review us and all the other things. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and take care.
And if someone is trying to tell you about their book and it's about rats and riding them, and that they're kind of the future of humanity, whew, just silently nod and then get out of there as quickly as possible.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by two true freaks. That's two true freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.